Bishop John of Westminster. Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Krasitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ritavarashim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anisantadami Bhagavad-gītē bhavad-dvaiṣṇī. We're on chapter 2, verse 22.
22? Mm-hmm. Should we translate that 21? Would you? 22 is good.
Yeah, 22. Vasamsi Chiranani Yatha Vihaya. Vasamsi Chiranani Yatha Vihaya. Navani Krishnani Naroparani. Navani Kredinani Naro Parani Tata Sharirani Vihaya Chirunani Tata Sharirani Vihaya Chirunani Anyani Samyati Navani Dehi Anyani Samyati Navani Dehi Vasamsi Jirunani Yatha Vihaya Navani Grinani Naraha Aparani Tata Sharirani Vihaya Jirnani Anyani Samyati Navani Dehi. Remember the context of Krishna really explaining to Arjuna Umar that in fact there is no cause for grief. He's going to be circling back to that all the time. There is no cause for grief because really there is no death. There is nothing that happens to the Atma. And so even though you think that you're going to be killing all of these people, you know, that you are that you'll be killing them or causing others to kill them, in fact, there is no such thing as death. So this is his theme right now. He'll go into different levels of this with the subtle body. He's starting to deal with it a little differently now. So he says, he uses an example. Vasamsi jiranani yatha vihaya. Yatha, just as, having given up vihaya, having given up vasamsi jiranani, old clothes, vihaya, having given up jiranani vasamsi, old clothes, Navani Krinani Naraha Aparani. A man, a person, takes on new ones, takes on others that are new. It's just as a person gets rid of their old clothes and then, you know, takes on a new set. Tata, similarly, Sharirani Vihaya Jiranani. Having given up an old body, Sharirani Jiranani, Anyani Samyati Navani Dehi, the indweller, the Atma, the self, takes on another that is new. Okay. And so there's some beautiful things to understand, because there's an experiential reality here that needs to be understood. You as a jiva, as an individual, have no identification with your clothes. You may like your clothes, but you don't feel that if you take your clothes off, you're going to die. You don't have that sensation. Or that you have that conclusion, right? And unless there's something terribly wrong, really, terribly wrong. You don't have that conclusion, right? You certainly have the conclusion that if you take off this body, if you lose this body, if this body drops, that something will happen to you, right? But what the verse is saying is just like if I were to take off these clothes and put on new clothes, which I do very comfortably with no problem, and how nothing happens to me in that activity, that I'm not losing myself in any way. In the same way, when I lose this body, when I take off this body, when this body dies, I will then take on a new body in the same way as taking off clothes and putting on new clothes. How there is absolutely no change to my being. That this body, in fact, is like a dress. Now, what needs to be understood here is that not only is this physical body like a dress, every moment of my experience is like a dress that I take on and take off. Like, for instance, a thought, for instance, is like a dress. A thought comes, you're now wearing the thought, right? The thought goes, and another thought comes. Now you've got rid of that old thought, and you've taken on a new thought. That's your new dress. Your perception through your sense organs are a dress. They're a dress of experience. And so now you have this dress, you know, and in a moment, you have another dress, because this dress is modified and changed in given ways. Or if I look in this direction, I have, this is now my dress. And now if I look in this direction, this is my dress. Right? The two dresses are completely different. Right? If I am happy, say we have emotional dresses. Say all is well with me, life is good. My unconscious is not acting up. Right? Everything is peaceful and fine. Life is sparkling. My mind is happy. That's a beautiful gown I'm wearing. I have a beautiful gown. You know? But then, like Cinderella, you know? The midnight comes. You know, midnight comes. And the gown goes away. And I'm left in the mental rags, right, of my hurt mind. The mental rags of my hurt mind. And now that's my dress. It's nice if I can think of it as a dress and not as me. You know? It's not think of it as a dress, though. If I recognize it as a dress, that's the difference. I can think of it as a dress. That's a nice idea. But I don't think of my clothes as a dress. I know they're a dress. I know these clothes are a dress and that they're not connected to me. That's my immediate experience. It's not a theory. It's not a theory. It's not a theoretical concept that my clothes are a dress and really when I take them off, I'll still be here. Right? And that I can put new ones on. That's not a theory. My inner environment also is not theoretical. It's not a theory. That I remain as the thoughts come and go. That I remain as my experience, my physical experiences, my sensual experiences through my sense organs, my emotional experiences, my mental experiences. All of these things come and go. I remain. That's not theory. That's reality. It's a matter of whether or not I recognize that reality, and whether or not I recognize that reality as clearly as I recognize the taking on and off of my clothes. Because let's think about it. If I am present to a thought, whatever mood I'm having right now, I'm aware of it, I'm present to that thought. And that's the truth. If I say, I can close my eyes and all right, let me just be aware of my mind, let me be aware of my situation. To say, you have to say, yes, I am here and I'm aware of the thought. The thought is your dress. You have to say that. These are just words labeling experience. They're not theory. They're words labeling your experience. Yes, I am aware of this thought. And now you watch that thought go and now you have the next thought. And you say, yes, I'm still here. I'm now aware of this thought. And then this thought. And then this thought. I'm changing the dresses quickly. Okay. These words that I'm speaking right now are actually labeling and pointing to the reality of your experience. And this is what we have to see, and seeing it is so helpful. It's so useful. I was just thinking in meditation that I was thinking about this verse and the implications of it. No matter what is going on, for a person who knows, who's recognized the stability of your presence, you may be very clear about the presence of your own being. And your mind is still creating havoc. And that would be natural. Right? Until it doesn't, it does. I don't know how to turn that buzzer off, so we just have to deal with it. Okay. So your mind can be creating, it can be creating so much havoc. Often when your mind's creating havoc, hopefully you've learned, you know, how to talk to yourself. Like you can self-soothe yourself. That's very helpful to just calm the mind down from this havoc that it's creating. But this is the point. Whether that self-soothing is taking place or the mind is creating havoc, there is a reality in that situation. And the reality of the situation is that you are present to it. You are present to your mind that's in pain. You are present to your mind that's creating havoc. And you are present to the one who is self-soothing. Right? The self is not self-soothing. The mind comes in and says, it's okay, don't worry. Or your mind is in pain and creating havoc. And your mind comes in and says, this is hell, I can't figure it out. And screw this.
I'm out of here.
There's nobody calming the waters. Right? And sometimes there's nobody that knows what to do. And that friend, that self-soothing friend, can come in and say, it's all right. And you can say, yeah, yeah. You know? What is true, though, in that situation? It's all true. They're all possibilities. What is true, no matter what your mind is doing, is that you are there. You are there. And you are changelessly there. Yourself is simply there, in exactly the way it was the moment before, and the moment before, and the hour before, and the day before. Yourself is still there as it was when the mind was peaceful, and when the mind is in absolute chaos. Yourself is still there. Now say you know this. You've learned this. Not known intellectually also, and nothing wrong with intellectually, but that intellectual knowledge is a knowledge of recognition of the truth of your experience. So say you know that. Okay? When that helps, when your situation gets to be really difficult, right? Means there's no self-soothing going on inside. There's just confusion. One really nice thing to do is to let that confusion be and not try to solve it. Sometimes you can't solve it, you know. You want to come up with some bright idea, come up with the answer, you know. Like, what is the answer? I can't figure this out. You know, I can't figure this out. You can just say, you know, that's right. You don't have a clue. You can't figure it out. You do not have an answer. And everything is a mess and in chaos and in pain. And there is no answer. The only thing that you can do, one thing that really is helpful, is to, when things are in that level of hurt and chaos, is to just recognize that you are there. And let the mind take refuge in your own presence. There's nobody providing an answer. There's nobody there saying how things are. There's nobody that feels like saying, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. perfect, but there is an inner reality. There is an inner reality. And that inner reality is that the self, yourself, is present to that chaos. And yourself is not involved in it. Yourself is exactly the same. Yourself is not saying anything one way or the other. Yourself just is being, the being that is you. And your mind can, in all of its pain and all of its levels of chaos, remember or sit, recognize, turn to that self. And it's not the type of turning to, when we think of meditation, we have to make our mind quiet. It's not that type of turning to. It's not a turning to that asks the chaotic mind to become quiet or to go away. It's not asking the hurtful mind or the disturbed mind to go away or to stop being disturbed. It is just letting that mind, in the totality of whatever it's dealing with, come home. Just to recognize, I'm still there. That is an amazing and wonderful experience. Because the painful, hurtful mind, the mind that's hurt and chaos and doesn't have a solution and doesn't feel like having an inner friend, can just be with that self, which it is with. So it's not like your mind has to try to be with it. It is with it. Because yourself hasn't gone anywhere. And so your mind can just recognize that fact. And what the mind will see in all of its pain and all of its chaos is, I'm still there and I'm still the same. And so the mind gains a soothing and a refuge from that. It's not about words. It's not about trying to logic the mind into a more peaceful behavior, which sometimes that's very, very helpful. Sometimes it is. But it's not necessarily about that. So when things get that bad and that chaotic, if you can allow it to be that way and kind of say, okay, I'm just going to be patient and wait this out. Jung talks about this. It's one of the great recognition he had in psychology. He talks about it like this. Your psyche as a whole is very intelligent. It's like the universe is intelligent. Your psyche is extremely intelligent. Mm-hmm. And there's much more to your psyche. There's much, it's like a huge ocean of intelligence and experience and chaos, a huge ocean of everything that is supporting this little island of the conscious ego, the conscious mind. This is kind of Jungian language, but still you can relate to it experientially. Mm-hmm. If you can just relax in yourself and let this chaos be, just recognize yourself and let this chaos be, then be a little patient and watch the psyche come up with its solution. Your own psyche will come up with a solution. It's what Jung calls the transcendent function. And that's something to learn. It's where you don't have a solution. Sometimes in life, you don't have a solution out here. Like you can be caught in a situation, you know, and I think everybody has had these situations in your life. You're caught in a situation, and no matter what you do in the situation, it's not going to work. Whatever you do, it's painful. It won't come to a good end. When you're in that type of a situation where there is nothing really that you can do, and you can see you'd want to do this. You might want to strike out in this way, or you might want to retreat, run away. Maybe you could run away, or you could strike out. Well, in some situations, say you decided my solution here is to just turn my back on so-and-so, or turn my back on my partner, or turn my back on my life, and just get out. But you know inside that if you do that, you'd be finished. And then the other solution was, well, maybe I should just strike out and let all these people have it. You know? And then you realize, well, if I do that, I also won't get what I want. Mm-hmm. And so then you find that yourself sitting in a situation that's very painful, but that you have no solution. You know, I'm just making up this example that I can relate to personally, but but you have your own. You should have your own example like that. You're in a situation. There's really no solution. And so you're just kind of caught steaming there with nothing to do. That's where Jung talks about these situations. And I find them Vedantically. They're really beautiful to understand them in terms of your own self. The best thing, when you don't have a solution, you don't even have a kind voice inside, you don't have anywhere to turn, is just to sit with it and let it be. Don't make a decision. Don't act on it. Just see with some shraddha, really, with an attitude of how your psyche is going to solve this problem for you. What Ishvara is going to do. What Ishvara is going to do. It's a very, very, very freeing. But what makes that type of a solution so beautiful and so profound is when you have already recognized, in reference to this teaching, because most of us, you know, have learned this and are gaining this knowledge. When you've recognized, when your mind is able to recognize that self that you are, that is present and not changing. If you've been able to make that differentiation of your own presence, of your own being, and to continually recognize that you are still here, changelessly here, no matter what, then if you have that, you can give some space and time for your psyche to solve situations that are bigger than your ego. They're bigger than your ego. They're bigger than your capacity. They're bigger than the inner friend. They're bigger than the skills that you have. That happens sometimes. But the one thing, they're not bigger than yourself. They will never be bigger than yourself. That's why if you can let everything just fall apart, and at that time, that's the greatest time in reference to your knowledge, to check it out and see if you're still there. Really, it's the greatest time. That'll give you really nishta. Gives you nishta. Because even in that hell, you're still there. Just an aside that's connected to this verse, actually. Once when I was, my first time in India, I was in India only about 6 months. And I had been traveling with Swamiji, going to class after class after class, and really very much getting it, even though as soon as I leave the class, it all closes over, but still, very, very wonderful, very profound. And then, after about 6 months, or 4 or 5 months, I guess, I became very ill with cholera. Terrible. And I got this cholera on the train, and by the time I was on my way down, Swamiji was in Madras, and a group of the students were all coming down from Rishikesh to Madras to attend the yajna that he was giving there. And so I got cholera on the way, right in the middle of this train ride. And by the time they got me to the Madras, I was taken to this little kind of a medical clinic that was actually run by some of Swamiji's doctors. He had a lot of devotees there, and he had a group of doctors. And so they got me to the clinic. And all during that time, from the time they picked me up, they met me at the train with a wheelchair and all of this. I guess they were able to wire ahead. I was totally almost out of it, so I don't know everything that happened. But they got me onto a wheelchair, and it got me into the car, and then to the where Swamiji was staying, and then he had them take me to this clinic. And all that time, you know, my sense organs were coming in and out of working, and my body was basically not functioning. You know, it never, ever occurred to me once, not once, it never crossed my mind that I was dying, because I never had the experience, because your being doesn't change in any way, not even a ripple. And by the time they got me to the clinic and onto the table, I had no pulse. I was dead. I mean, you know, I wasn't, obviously, but there was no pulse. And I remember when I was on the table, there was one point there where there was no connection at all with my body. There was no body. There was just one, this must have only taken place in a few seconds at the most. There was a thought that went through my mind. All there was this kind of ephemeral thought. There's nothing else. But the thought was something like, oh, this is what Swamiji was talking about. That was the thought. And then by that time they had given me an IV of glucose and all of this, you know. Like, and I came swishing back into my body like kind of like a tidal wave, like a huge force. And shortly after that, so then I was, my eyes were open, and I was just kind of there on the gurney or whatever. And Swamiji came in, and he patted me on the hand, and he looked at me, and I didn't realize. It never occurred to me that there was anything wrong with me, because there isn't. That's the thing. There is nothing wrong with you, with who you are, with your being. You know, it was a very traumatic, dramatic experience of illness. But there was never the slightest thought of death, because there's not a flicker of change in your being. And so then Swamiji came and asked how I was, and I told him everything that would just happen, you know. I was just lying on my back, and I was talking to him and looking at him. And he patted me and said, very good, very good. He said, you're very fortunate. And I said, yeah, you know. And then he said, well, then he goes, so he said a few more things. And he goes, well, now, you just stay here and rest, and we're going to be going off up to Kuti, I think it was. It was a hill station. And you'll stay here now, and you'll rest, and you stay with Sarojini, who's a very good friend of mine, a doctor. You stay here, and we're going to be going, and she'll be well taken care of. And I said, no, I'm coming. And I went to move to get up, and nothing happened. I could not even lift my head. It was shocking, you know. But, you know, I was very fortunate to have that severe, extreme differentiation where you actually are put in a situation in the midst of this teaching where you recognize that, in fact, nothing happens to you. Absolutely nothing. And we actually experience this changelessness of ourselves. And that's why Swamiji said, good, 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 that's very fortunate. Yeah, that's right. But we, you know, we experience this extreme changelessness of ourself always. Mm. Always. We are never without that experience. It's just that it is not recognized. And that's why we spend so much time trying to differentiate it from that which changes, you know? Because the changeless you is there. It is central to the entirety of your experience. In fact, there is no experience that's away from the changeless presence of your being. But because there is no experience on any level that is away from the changeless being, which is the very self of that experience, actually. But because there's nothing at all that's ever away from it, the mind takes it completely for granted as its own self. It is the silent being and background, the very material, the very stuff of which everything is made. And so it's never recognized, you know, because it is always there, always changelessly there. And so it is going to be changelessly there in love and hatred and anxiety and beauty and ugliness. You know, it will be there changelessly there in everything. Mm-hmm. And so you won't bother to differentiate it. Now, to make it more personal, we say like this: you are changelessly there in every experience that you have. That's why it's you, right? That's why you say, you know, I had this experience and I had this experience. I thought this, I thought that. I felt this, I felt that. That's your constant experience. I, me, I am the one who is central to all experience, and that central being never changes at all. But the mind is so conditioned totally to only be relating to itself. It relates to its own thoughts, its own perceptions. This is why in the whole teaching methodology, we divide the types of cognitions that we have into four. There's many, many millions of cognitions, but we divide the cognitions into four basic types, because these four types are always playing with each other. Like one is the chitta, you have memories. So you can be recalling memories all of the time. Okay? You're recalling, you recall a memory, and then the buddhi, the intellect, can comment on the memory. That's another type of thought. Right? And so the memory and the buddhi and the intellect are interchanging dialoguing with each other. What about the ahankara, the I notion? Right? The I notion that says, I just had this memory and I am thinking about this. That's another cognition, right? It's a cognition. All of this activity belongs to the mind. And then there's the manas, which is really the mind stuff that is responsible for the experience of emotions, actually. It's not a decisive thought. It's the thought, it's the fluctuating mind, and also the mind that gets itself entangled, that allows for the experience of dukkha, for sorrow, actually. But these are four types of cognitions that are always interacting one with the other, one commenting on the other. Just think of it. Even in reference to, if you look at your mind, through using the sense organs, is taking on perception after perception, dress after dress after dress in terms of the perception. Okay? Those are perceptions brought about by the sense organs. But then the mind comes in with these four types of cognitions, can bring the ahankara in, and it can say, oh, I am seeing the painting, the I am, right? It's making a comment on the perception. The buddhi, the intellect, can come in and say, this is a really interesting painting. I'm sure that that's from Southern California. I know exactly the place where that painting is, right? And so the memory is then brought in also. The buddhi can say, you know, I think this is a wonderful painting of Southern California, but the memory remembers, it relates the painting to Southern California. You see, so these are cognitions that are reacting to your perceptions or reacting to your emotions. Now, say you have a cognition, the manas. You have a dukkha vritti, sorrow. You have sorrow and depression. Now your intellect, based upon what it has learned, right, is going to comment on the sorrow, and so will the ahankara. The ahankara will come in and say, I am sorrowful. That's a cognition, a thought. The buddhi will say, you know, it's not necessary for you to be sorrowful because of such and such and such. Or the ahankara will come, or another type of buddhi will come in and say, you're sorrowful because you made a huge mistake, you idiot. That's what I'm saying. All of this activity, right, is taking place in me. I'm present to all of it. I'm not making a comment. I'm the very stuff of all of that activity. I am the changeless being, the changeless presence that is as much there in the buddhi, in the intellect, as in the ahankara, in the I notion, in the memory, in the sorrowful vritti, the happy vritti, as in the perception. I am there. I'm the very stuff of it, the changeless stuff of it. And so nobody bothers, right? The mind doesn't bother about that because it has totally taken it unto itself. This is the problem. the mind has taken my being totally unto itself. And so if the mind is happy, I am happy. If the mind is unhappy, I am unhappy. If the mind is thoughtful, I am thoughtful. If the mind is rude, I am rude. I am whatever condition the mind is in. That is it. That's the identification. Once this identification has been broken through knowledge, through recognition, you have a different environment inside. Very different environment. The environment is the same. Nothing's changed. It was like that before. You knew about it. But now the recognition, the mind, the ignorance has been removed. And ignorance has been removed from the mind that makes you able to recognize, to differentiate yourself, the mind, the thinking mind, from you, your being. Once that differentiation takes place, it's a whole different ballgame. Because when that differentiation takes place, the whole mind and all the aspects of it, good and bad, all of its confusion and all of its clarity, takes place, has in a home which is stable. It has a stable being, right? And that stable being is yourself. Now, when that's known, no matter what the mind is going through, if you can't solve a problem, if it gets into a mess, if it's creating a big hell and problem for you, one thing you can do is just, okay, it's a terrible mess. That's right. That's what it is. It's a mess and it's painful and you're just going to have to wait it out. That's a fact. Yeah. And so what helps to wait it out? Is to be able to recognize your home. To go home, you know. To tell your mind, okay, let's just go home for a while. Let's just be with myself for a while. It's not trying to make your mind be quiet. Just say, just let me be with myself for a while. And what is so wonderful is that yourself is always there. And it is always there in the same way. Now, what makes a person not understand this or not understand Vedanta is that you're often, until this is understood, you're asking that the home of yourself to be a sukha-vritti, to be a happy mind. That's the problem. Sometimes your mind's not happy, you know? And so then your unhappy mind has no home then. Right? Atma is not happy, it's not sad. It's ananda. The Atma, yourself, it's not bliss or pleasure or joy. And it's not none of these things. You could say it's love, but it's not the love that comes and goes. So if you use a word of like love or a word like wholeness or a word like fullness, these words are actually pretty good. But you need to take the relative nature away. So it's the fullness that's there in the presence of loneliness. The love that's there in the presence of hatred. Like if you're feeling bitter and angry and hateful, you can bring that hateful, angry mind home to the self that is exactly the same as when the mind is loving and compassionate and joyous. Yourself is not loving, compassionate, joyous, bitter, hateful, or angry. Yourself is what only it is. There is no thing out here or emotional experience which is the same as your own presence. And so when we use words to point to the presence of yourself, to your own being, sometimes those words can be misleading. You know, they can take us astray. Like, for instance, if we say, like use the word ananda. We even say things like, which are true, say things like this, like when your mind fulfills a desire, at that time the mind becomes happy, right? And then I'll say, because the mind is relaxed, and we can say something like, it reflects the self. Problem. That language is a problem. Because then we think that the happy experience that the mind is enjoying is a reflection of the happy experience inside, the nature of the self, which is not there when the mind is sorrowful. Right? So then what we think is, all right, when I fulfill a desire or when I meditate or when the mind becomes relaxed and quiet so that it's like a mirror, right? It reflects the self that is otherwise not reflected and therefore not known. And that is not it. That's why all of these illustrations need to be used and then destroyed. You use them so they do the job, and then you tell what's wrong with the illustration. Because the illustrations, you need them. You need them to point to something. But then once they've done their job, what they've done is not quite right. So then you have to fix it. Okay, so here's the fix. It's true that when you fulfill a desire, the mind becomes relaxed. You know, it becomes relaxed. Or when you meditate, or when you take a walk in the park, or when you take drugs or a glass of wine, or whatever does it, to make your mind at that moment not want anything. In that condition, I would say maybe like this, we can say the self is reflected in it, but that can be misleading. Mm-hmm. So you could say that the mind is in a condition, you know, which does not compete in any way with your own nature. It's not contributing any sorrow, right? It doesn't contribute any sorrow. And it reflects the self, now if you go like this, it reflects the self kind of like the sun reflected in a mirror. If you recognize this, okay, this is the difference. If you use the thing, this, in a quiet mind, the sun reflects, right, in a mirror or in a clear bucket of water, if we use, the sun reflects in that bucket of water. Okay, that's clear enough. But now, the reflection in the water is a different experience. There's the reflection. The reflection is not the sun, right? The reflection is its own experience, and it's a reflection in the water. So we're not talking about the sun now. We're talking about the reflection of the sun in the water. Everybody with me on that? Mm-hmm. That reflection of the sun in the water is an experience. The reflection of the self, or the nature of the self in a quiet mind, is an experience. Right? But that experience of the quiet mind, which reflects the self, is what we call happiness or joy. And that quiet mind, when it becomes really, really quiet, it becomes very loving or very deeply joyful or deep ananda when it becomes very, very quiet. When it becomes less quiet, you know, a little bit more dense, it becomes pleasurable. And so we have a gradiated experiences of this reflected sun, of this reflected self. Okay with everybody? That reflected self, for this, let's go to the sun, that reflected sun is not the experience of the sun. The reflection of the sun is not the experience of the sun. Okay? The sun is a different experience. It is its own experience. The sun reflected in the mind, that reflection is different. The mental experience. That's a different experience. Now, so if we stick with the sun for a minute. The sun experience and the reflection experience are happening at the same time. Right? The sun's experience and the reflection in the water experience are happening at exactly the same time. What if you threw a bunch of mud in the water? Then the sun experience is happening exactly as it was before. And now the water that's being illumined by the sun doesn't reflect the sun in the same way. And so that experience is changing, right? So the reflection is not the same because the condition of the water is different. But the sun experience is exactly the same. It hasn't rippled at all. Does everybody see that? So now look at, in your inner space, the space of your own being and your mind, there is an experience which is yourself. It is its own experience. It's not an experience of something. It's not an experience you're looking at. It's just the self-evident experience of your being. That experience never changes. And that experience in and of itself, we call ananda. That means that the self-experience, the me, your own presence, which is changeless, which is constant, that never ripples, is what we call ananda, or wholeness, or absolutely full and complete and solid. Nothing ever happens to you at all. And it is absolutely full, purna. That's the swarupananda, the ananda, the fullness of your own being. When the mind is relaxed, that relaxed mind reflects your being in a way that we call happiness or joy or bliss, you know, or pleasure. But that kind of experience, that reflected experience, comes and goes based upon the condition of the mind. And so these joys and happinesses are coming and going while the ananda of your being is not coming and going. So it's not like your being, your mind becomes quiet and now it reflects the happiness of yourself. And so now the happiness of yourself is known. And if your mind could become just a little bit more quiet, more happiness of yourself would be known. That isn't it. The ananda, the fullness of yourself, is never, never not experienced. It is always exactly the same. And so if you're looking for a bliss experience, then you're stuck into looking for particular types of vrittis, thought modifications in the mind. Those thought modifications are dresses. You always want to have the pretty dress on. You want the ball, you know. I always want to be going to the ball with a pretty, beautiful dress. Right? There's nothing wrong with that. Say, you know, I always want my mind to be beautiful and loving and peaceful. That's nice. There's nothing wrong with that. You know. But the mind by nature is subject to change, right? The one that you can rely on being always the same is only one. That's your being. That's the one that is always the same no matter what. It doesn't fluctuate no matter what the condition of mind is. That's where the moksha, that's the moksha. The recognition that I am free is the recognition that I am free. I'm not going to recognize that my mind is free because my mind isn't free. The mind by nature is subject to change. The body by nature is subject to change. The body is subject to death. The mind is subject to all kinds of things. Like Swamiji once said, you know, my mind does all kinds of funny things. So what? So what? But then you have to have knowledge to be able to say that, so what? You have to have knowledge to accommodate the world. And to accommodating the world means accommodating your mind also. You know? And accommodating not knowing, accommodating lack of clarity, accommodating not being able to solve the problem, you know? Patience, you know? But all of that comes. All of that comes with the recognition of a self, you know? That is okay as it is. Right? A self that can't be improved upon. Right? A self that your mind can't improve. When I realized that, I was so relieved. Because we all work so hard, you know, to improve. there's no end to improvement. Yeah? I mean, I think that we all naturally, as human beings, we all naturally improve in the way that a flower grows. You know? You improve organically, step by step, you grow and you improve and you unfold and you grow and you grow and you grow and you grow. You need to be able to enjoy that process because it never stops. You know? You go on growing and growing and changing and changing and changing and learning and assimilating. So your mind becomes, you know, more and more wise and more beautiful and more caring and has to deal with more. Then it gets thrown a new experience that's too hard for you to handle. You become more and more wise and more wise and more wise. And then you get thrown another one. And then you have to learn, you know. Yourself isn't improving. Yourself's not improving. Yourself is already whole and complete as it is and changeless. So the mind can just rest there. That is the liberation. And that mind having that home, which is really the source for its ananda, relieves the mind. It relieves the mind of such a burden of having to become whole and having to become complete. And it realizes that your being is already that accomplished fact. You know? That's the changeless being that one has to recognize to be free. Right. That's where the freedom is. Now, just one few more words on this. When you recognize the changelessness of your being amidst all experience that you're having here, all the experience that you have through your sense organs, all the experiences that you have of your body, which is only known through your sense organs, right? You have no other experience. You can't experience your body without your sense organs. Your sense organs are the vehicle for that experience. The thoughts of in your mind, every thought that you have is illumined. Every thought comes and goes. All of these experiences. If you recognize all of these things are coming and going in your presence, if you can recognize the reality, the fact that you are not coming and going as all of these things are changing, what can change that reality? What would change that reality? Already that's the reality. All of these things, all experience comes and goes in the changeless presence of yourself. That is your reality. It is your reality that your being, the conscious being that you are, is not an object that you can look at or that you can touch or that you can do anything to, in fact. It's non-objectifiable. As an object. That is the reality. What will change that? So if you try to think about that, even if you think, this is why we have all these prakriyas, all these teaching methodologies to make you see this. Bhagavan gave us some prakriyas, some methodologies that are just... You can't do anything when you see it. You can't say anything. If you take the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state, these three states of experience, that these three states of experience that you go through day after day after day, how they all negate each other. Everything about this waking state is totally negated in the dream state. It's one negates the other. In the dream state, there is no waking or dream. The fact that this is not a problem for you is huge. That you can go to the dream state, go to the deep sleep state, wake up to the waking state, and just nonchalantly say, you know, I had a dream last night, and this is what happened, you know. Where in fact, when you're having that dream, which is the most natural condition in the world for you, it's absolutely natural, which it is, you know, in that state, you don't have a physical body. You're identified with another body. You don't have this universe. You're existing in another universe. You know? Sometimes in that dream state, you don't even have a body. That's not a problem. And you know what? It isn't a problem. It's so much not a problem that you take it completely for granted. But when you analyze what is being said in reference to this experience here in the waking state, the asangatvam, the non-attached nature of you, of your being, the reality of that, that you experience right here and now, that, of course, would be the situation when this waking state is not being experienced and the dream experience is there. That would not be a problem for you because you are changeless here. And so this universe, the passing on of this universe and the taking on of another, is not going to be a problem at all. Because there is asanga here. There is no attachment here. So why would there be any attachment there? Or in the deep sleep, or in the waking? So that's what needs to be, the reality of it needs to be recognized. Even when you're walking around and you're talking to people, and you're taking a walk, you should always just check it out. Check yourself out. Yes, are you still here? You know, are you here? The best times to do it is when you're really upset. Who cares about knowledge when you're happy? Yeah. Nobody cares. But you know, your knowledge comes to your rescue. Knowledge comes to your rescue. You know, when things are not that good. When things are not that good. Then you see, you know, what you have to fall back on. See if yourself is still there. It's a beautiful time to own up your knowledge. It's good not to put down happiness. When you're happy also, that's a beautiful time to own up your knowledge also. To just sit with the source of that happiness. Anytime you have a really happy experience, just close your eyes and go to your own being. Just sit with your being. Yeah. Always see if you can recognize the one that is always there no matter what the experience is. Then, you know, all of this becomes a dress. All dresses come and go. You have to see the whole, every moment like that. It's just a dress that comes and goes and comes and goes, and there's somebody here, yourself, that doesn't. So.
Nice.
Let's just take a minute. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Parts of the brain, how these different parts of the mind that we talk about in Vedanta correspond with these different parts of the brain as well. And as I was thinking about it in that way, I realized my mind relaxes when I'm able to ground the knowledge in something that seems concrete to me. Otherwise, it starts to seem ephemeral. I know what these words mean, but so the insight that I have is, for me, it seems like part of the gaining clarity and differentiating between the changing and the changeless requires a more thorough understanding of truth and how it's working. That is a significant part of the process of removing ignorance.
I think that's true. I think that's true because I think that the intellect needs to understand its experience. And this is a lot of the experience, right? So you have to understand how, like we say, God, creation, and self. God, creation, individual. How does this individual fit into the creation? What is the relationship of the creation to God? What is all of this going on? And how does that... And what is the relationship of the self or reality, the Paramartika, the Atma, to all of this? And you need to understand it.
So it is, I guess the question is it valid to think that a more thorough understanding of duality is necessary for the mind to relax enough to recognize that I'm whole?
Well, I think there's an infinite things in duality to understand, right? But say if we want to understand the duality that we're experiencing ourselves in, like the duality of myself in this creation and the laws that, you know, that involve myself, that needs to be understood. That doesn't mean you have to become a biologist or a nuclear scientist. It means you have to understand mithya. You have to understand maya. You have to understand your experience.
Right, the experience that I'm having.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And the mind, you have to understand, your mind has to understand it to the point of clarity. Your clarity. Yeah. Yeah, it's very important. That's why you can't just, it's not enough for the mind even just to recognize the changelessness of your being, that experience of changeless being, your own self, that recognition. That's not enough. In fact, it has to end up with recognizing that I am the whole, because the mind won't stop there until it understands what all of this is and who am I and what am I doing here. You know, that involves duality. Who am I? What am I doing here? What is God? Why did I come here? Why did this creation come? All of that. All of those questions.
Kristen, what Kristen brought up reminds me of a statement that, I mean, I've heard this before. I wish I had asked this question, but I never have. It was, teach me the knowledge by which all other knowledge is known.
Well, that's how the Mundaka Upanishad starts.
Is that how you think? Yeah.
Knowing, what is that one thing knowing which all of, everything is known?
Yeah. Now, but also it made me think of that this is something that often gets talked about. And they talk about that a lot of times when a person is working, they get into what's known as a flow state,
mm-hmm.
where you basically feel this happiness, where you basically, you know, lose your sense of time. And athletes talk about it. People who work, who are really involved in what they do, often talk about it as being very wonderful. It's a wonderful feeling. And in a way, maybe what you were noticing was kind of related to that somehow, that you know, that you experience when you're listening to this, you go to what you are good at doing, which is, you know, you go to your science model because you're so accustomed to working it that you're experiencing some of this bliss in that, you know, in relating it to what you know, something like that.
Well, the those flow states, all of those things like people have in sports or when you're in music especially or sports, those are just experiences.
Yeah.
They don't have anything to do with knowledge.
But that experience, so they are a state where the mind is relaxed.
Yeah.
So to
sure.
some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, to follow up on what I was saying, I think part of the question, where the question is coming from about the validity of what I was suggesting is, I have my doubts, because I think the mind wants to think it knows something, that it has a certain kind of knowledge, scientific knowledge, or a religious understanding, and so the idea that I need that understanding in order to, it's a slippery slope, because I start to think, I need that to, it's almost becomes, I need that to be happy, and then I need to be in that state in order to recognize, in order to relax into I'm just confused about the extent to which it is necessary to have the kind of intellectual understandings that I was talking about when I first started asking the question, and if that's just an illusion, or if that's just something that the ego wants. The ego wants to believe that it has a comprehensive understanding of something, and that that's necessary in order to have self-knowledge.
I think you have to have a comprehensive understanding of the language the knowledge is being taught in. I think you need that. You need to be able to understand the language. You know, you have to have a mind that's developed and capable of viveka, logical thinking. But I don't think you need to be an expert in any given field of knowledge. You know, I don't even think you need, you don't even need to have Sanskrit. You don't have to be a Hindu. You just have to have a mind that's capable of reasoning and that has those qualities of mumukshutvam, you know, desire for liberation, and has certain level of maturity and can follow the language. So there's qualifications of the mind, you know, being able to have enough shanti to be able to follow, have some viveka, ability to discriminate, have recognized on at least a cursory level, at least, the problem of samsara, that everything is bound by change, that there is no way to accomplish wholeness or completeness in this world through the acquiring of knowledge or through the acquiring, you know, knowledge from samsara or the acquiring of objects or anything. Mind has to have come to certain understandings to have an opening, to be open to this knowledge, because otherwise this knowledge is just one of the knowledges.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the many, many knowledges. In Vedanta, what the Upanishads have to say is not one of the many knowledges.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a knowledge of something objective in the world.
Speaking of language, when you're saying mind, are you primarily talking about the function of the mana? And then I'm also wondering if you could elaborate on buddhi. Is it just solely the capacity for viveka, or is there more to buddhi than that?
Buddhi is really the mind's ability to make a decision, the determinative thinking. And so knowledge really belongs to the buddhi. Because when you recognize something as knowledge, that's a determination, right? Mm-hmm. So buddhi and knowledge go together. The manas has more to do with feeling and emotion and indecisiveness in the fluctuating mind. Chitta is memory. And the ahankara is just the I notion that really misidentifies the Atma with all of the experiences that you're having. Like I am thinking, I am feeling, I am seeing, this I am thought that ties the Atma with the experience. That's the Ahankara. Is that what you wanted to know?
So you said that kind of nicely before. It kind of made me smile when you said, you know, when at a time of when you have a contraction or you have like an emotional experience, let's say a traumatic experience, so you might be walking through this world, or I might be, I could just talk about myself, I just have this experience, you know, that everything I might actually feel very much of that changelessness on a deeper level inside myself. But then there's something that triggers, maybe partner does something, you know. Partner is normally the person who is really good at that, you know. So so she triggers something, you know, and it's like, there's a certain, what is actually happening at that junction there, you know, where there's in one moment, not just a kind of an experience of blissed out or so, but there's actually a sense of that beingness resting in that changelessness. And then suddenly, once there's a certain kind of, if there's a core wounding stimulated at a certain moment, what actually happens is that just that this vritti suddenly arises, like
it's triggered.
Yeah, so is that just like this, but those vrittis, and I know, and it's kind of interesting psychologically to work with these vrittis, because I think psychologically to actually work with them, next to having taking a psychosomatic approach to the whole thing, is very useful. And I can see that it seems like there's a certain unwinding process that happens with these vrittis. But on the other hand, what you were just saying today, what I really got from that is there's a certain, if that understanding is really there on the inside anchor in that changelessness, then how can a vritti then still have so much power? That's just kind of, that seems kind of absurd, because, you know, it's like, it seems like a super, superimposition or something, you know,
it is
a kind of weird nature, you know.
It has power because it's still loaded in the unconscious. But once, you know, you have that objectivity toward it and are able to be, it loses its power, but not initially. You know, you have to become conscious of that whole process. As that process comes into consciousness, it loses its power.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say it's not like that. I've never worked with it, you know. I mean, I think there's on a certain level, there's things, that's why I'm just recognizing it depends on how deep are we willing to go with it. And it seems like there's more and more coming up. And the clarity is actually increasing at the same time.
There is more and more coming up, and the clarity will keep increasing, and more will keep coming up.
Right.
Yeah.
And that just somehow, from the perspective of getting a deeper understanding through Vedanta about the changelessness, the changeless nature of Atma, of the self, you know, it just kind of feels like borderline paradoxical. So, you know, how can that be? You know, that it just feels like, I guess, the idea, the concept that I have in my mind is, it's like, if I have a deeper understanding of Vedanta and of the changelessness of that, that should also kind of ripple into, in a really deep way, should ripple into those areas of my having a full vision of my vrittis, and actually also starting to actually get a better grip on them. And on some level I feel that, but on this, because it keeps going deeper and deeper, it's just kind of wondering, because there's a certain, and I don't want to go too much into this, I just want to say there is a certain power in these cool wounding patterns that I discover, you know, not just in myself and everybody, my clients and me and everywhere they are, you know, even without having studied psychology in any kind of great depth, but I can recognize them, they just become like obvious, you know, they just become like, yeah, that's kind of what we're dealing with, you know, and so I guess I'm just looking for the link. How can I connect this understanding that you're so beautifully unfolding here, and can actually apply that more radically to my relative life or something? You know?
Well,
like that these, you know, yeah. I think I've said enough.
Well, I think that it very naturally and organically works its way through your entire psyche.
Uh-huh.
And it takes a while, especially initially, as this vision becomes clear to you, you know, then all layers and layers of stuff that are problematic
mm-hmm.
work their way out.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the big problematic supercharged stuff is gone. That works through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the psyche itself works its way through all of its stuff, presenting itself to you, you know, as the psyche, the more the psyche relaxes, the more it has to present to you.
Mm-hmm.
And as it presents it, it's presenting to you, the one who has knowledge. Then that material gets assimilated. So the mind becomes more and more and more at peace and more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And it works its way through. Yeah.
So there is a refinement process in the buddhi, specifically.
And in the manas and the whole, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Because even, say, without this knowledge, forget the knowledge and just say you have some psychological understanding, you're psychologically mature, say.
Mm-hmm.
Then as your complexes come up and as problems come up, you are a bigger person, deeper person.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that person that is now holding these complexes and problems.
Mm-hmm.
And so they keep changing and growing in the light of who you are now.
Mm-hmm.
So once once your knowledge becomes clear, right, then the problems and complexes come up, they present themselves to who you are now.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're assimilated in the light of who you are now and resolved in that light. Mm-hmm. Before they weren't resolved in knowledge. They might have been resolved in a deeper, more wiser you, but they weren't resolved in one who had self-knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That's totally different.
Do you think that, like, really, you know, as the psychological stuff comes up and presents and, you know, you see it in the light of your knowledge, but do you think that kind of, those things can actually stop or block the recognition of I am the whole? Maybe. I mean, those things have to be dealt with first.
I would say like this, and I think this is more the Vedantic way of looking at it. The knowledge, the complex, whatever it is, comes up, and then it comes up into the light of your knowledge, right? And when the complex is there, you're experiencing that pain, but then the knowledge itself helps to relieve the complex.
Mm-hmm.
Then the complex gets relieved, the mind is more peaceful, and so its understanding deepens. Then with that deeper understanding, another layer of complexes comes up. And so
the same one.
Oh, the same one. But what I'm saying is that they help each other,
yeah.
You know.
But earlier you said, I forget who you were, this question you were answering, but you were saying, you know, that it doesn't stop until you know I am the whole. I mean, you want to know that. So I'm just wondering maybe if the complex is kind of...
Well, you know what, you go on understanding I am the whole. You go on understanding it and seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
But the seeing has to become a very integrated knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that just takes place in time, you know, with exposure and with your mind's working through its problems. And a lot of it has to do with the lack of vairagya which everybody starts with some, a little bit of vairagya. And that vairagya keeps growing. As my mind becomes more and more peaceful and more whole, as my self-experience, you know, is I am whole, I am complete, then I become less and less needy of having to have you be a certain way, or the world be a certain way, or this be like that so that I can be happy. I quit demanding that. The less I demand that, the more I'm just appreciative of Ishwara. And the more I recognize kind of my own presence, because my mind isn't overactive trying to make things be this way or that way so I can be happy, right? So there's a settling, you know, and it takes, that settling takes place over years. But you start to, after once your knowledge is clear, you enjoy that process of maturing. Like Swamiji so often used the example, you know, so you have a beautiful rosebud, and you can just enjoy moment by moment, day by day, month by month, as that thing naturally grows. But if you're impatient, you know, and try to, you get this poor little thing, you mangled little rosebud, that you can, you know, it's a beautiful thing to watch yourself grow and mature.
And by the way, you mean recognizing the changeless, your changeless nature.
Well, I would say with the vairagya, what I mean is, vairagya is a natural result of this knowledge, because in two ways. Once I recognize myself as the source of the ananda and not the object, my mind no longer, it loses this need to go out here to get this so that I can be happy. Right? And even though it does that just automatically because of lifetimes of conditioning, you know, as it continues to do it, your mind recognizes that in the light of what you know and keeps letting go and letting go and letting go, and allowing the life to be what it is.
Well, so it looks to me like it's kind of a very delicate balance of what do you touch and what don't you touch. You know, when do you just keep recognizing the wholeness of yourself, or when do you get involved with trying to sort out a few of the...
I don't think you have to worry about it, because I think the main thing is, say if you are doing shravana. You keep doing shravana. Shravana means you expose yourself to this teaching so that you're always, your mind is always getting a clean slate. You know, you're always taking back, you're taking back home, and you're taking back home and you're giving that clarity. Okay?
Yeah.
Then your mind, your knowledge is what now, so you have understanding. Your knowledge is what all of your experience comes into. And without self-knowledge, it's that way, right? Your experiences come into you and to your knowledge. And so as your knowledge becomes clear, more and more clear, then you become more and more adept at being with your experience in a way which is true to your knowledge. And so if your experiences are good, that's why in the whole Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you know, this is the kshetra, this is the field. I'm the kshetra. You shouldn't run away from the field of your life. Be in your life. Because if you have to go off and meditate in a corner somewhere and escape your life, say, here I use the example, you know, to go up into the Himalayas. Because you think you'll be able to be happy in the Himalayas because you can't stand being at home with your family, you know.
I'm your wife.
But they say, no. Keep doing shravana and stay in your situation. Because that's the field. That's why the whole life, you look at the entire life as a sadhana, every moment. Mm-hmm. It's a sadhana for your mind to gain that shanti. You know, to be able to be whole and complete in the midst of life. And even to be whole and complete in the midst of your mind. That's possible. Honestly, and the reason it's possible is because once you really gain knowledge, yourself is totally, completely present in whatever the vritti is, good or bad. And once that's recognized, without doubt, if the doubts are gone, you're clear, that's recognized. But that's never not the case. You can have confused, unhappy vrittis, which are not most pleasant, you know. But you are brightly shining through, right? And that's the reality. And that reality becomes more and more kind of, what do you call it, a figure ground. It, yourself becomes much more dominant. Because the mind's just much more aware.
It's interesting that you're saying that, you know, because it seems, if you really start tracking these emotions more closely, one seems to realize that the timing factor is really essential, because you might kind of get triggered by something and you don't recognize it in that moment because of lack of awareness, and suddenly something else comes along and suddenly it's like, whoa, you know, it's like, and then it's also obvious at the same time that that other second thing that happened cannot really have created that sort of emotion. So there's obviously, there's a saying, you're never angry for the reason you think. And I actually remember that often when I feel that way, because whenever I check, it's true. You know, I recognize there is no actually direct correlation between if somebody triggers me, because there's something normally, something else that happened before that was just where I was not up to beat, when I recognized that felt kind of hurtful or that didn't feel right, or, you know, I didn't respond to that. And then I dragged it into the next moment. And I think that's very common, that we kind of miss, because of lack of awareness, that we miss these junction points where we didn't speak the truth, or where we weren't honest, or, you know, where there was something that was just not right on the beat. And then that's where the confusion comes in also, you know, because it's, you're just in clarity. You just say, hey, okay, well, you can actually be with what you just suggested. You are with a feeling, well, this kind of hurts. But if you don't even recognize that it hurts, it still goes in. But then, you know, you might feel it like 2 hours later, you know, and it just kind of comes on, and it's like, whoa, you know, it's like, what's this about, you know?
But that's right.
That's why people get so pissed when they drive their cars, right? I mean, it can't be that somebody kind of drives like 5 miles slower than you or faster, or, you know what I mean? I mean, it can't be that. You know? It's so obvious. So.
Yeah.
It's just the chitra, you know. That's the chitra, you know.
Yeah.
Boom.
Stuck in traffic. Mind's traffic.
Well, we all got a clean slate tonight.
Yeah.
All right.